Accession number 26562, reel number 5. Mr. Ken Taylor. We got to the point on the Formidable, where we were discussing, after the degaussing. What happened next? What was the next thing you remember aboard the Formidable?
Well, after all the trials, we sailed and we were virtually dashing around the North and South Atlantic after the Admiral Scheer. You know, every time there was an enemy report came through from merchant ships or something saying they think they sighted it. So virtually we were dashing, between the South American coast to the African coast, back and forth. Then after that...
Now, what do you remember of that period? Was there anything particular happening,
Well, the one thing that sticks in my mind was my first Christmas dinner at sea. We were going... I think the Formidable was rated for 39 knots and we were going flat out. And we did a sudden 90-degree turn and everything in the galley went haywire and the galley caught fire and the Christmas dinner was ruined and we ended up with corned beef and mashed potato. That was my first Christmas dinner at sea.
Were there any other celebrations put on for you, right, other than the sport?
Yeah, our crossing the line ceremony.
I meant at Christmas. I've come to the crossing line. Oh, yeah. Anything else done for you at Christmas, or was that just it, the spoiled meal?
Yeah, spoiled meal, basically. I mean, there's been war conditions, there wasn't much else to be done.
Would the crossing the line ceremony be at this period, or was that later? Did you cross the line at that time?
It was sometime during this period, because we had to, very first time we actually crossed the line. I suppose the one thing that stood out in my mind, which perhaps happened before we started chasing this year, was our first foreign port of call was Freetown. And this sticks out in my mind. I went up on the upper deck and saw the sandy beaches and the palm trees, and I thought, oh, wonderful. And the thing that shook me was, from geography lessons at school, you see all these major cities of the world with a big black dot on the map. And Freetown had a dot the same size as London. When you got there, it was all tin shanties.
So what did you do at Freetown? Did you get ashore at all?
Oh, yes. Well, yeah, I went ashore, and there was a... If I remember right, a small sort of fleet canteen where you could have a drink. Wandered around, bought a few photographs of, natives and that sort of thing. One of the things that stands out in my mind is a little kid coming up and saying, would you like a nice white school teacher? So we followed him, and the nice white school teacher turned about a big, fat, black mama sitting by the door like this. And it sticks out in your mind as a youngster because you're not interested in that sort of thing. And, nice white school teacher.
Now, what about the crossing the line ceremony? What do you remember of that? What actually was it on the Formidable? What did you do?
Oh, they out of camp, because they on these aircraft carriers, they made like a swimming pool out of canvas with a big sisal rope round the top. So when you filled water, the actual rope floated up, and so on the deck when there was nothing happening, you could have a swim when you were at sea. And because they used this, and they had the old ducking chair, and some of the crew dressed up as Neptune. I've still got the certificate upstairs in my den on the wall out there, crossing the line certificate, yeah. Everyone got a certificate. You get shaved and ducked in the water, that sort of thing. Everybody, first time crossing the line, officers, anybody, all got the old ceremony, being ducked.
So it was a bit of a laugh.
Yes.
And what else do you remember from that time? Well, I mean, you never caught up with the Admiral Scheer.
No. Then
tell us a bit about the daily routine then. What would a typical day be like for you as a young lad? Because you're still a boy, weren't you?
Well, I mean, I think 6 o'clock was rising. But because being a watchkeeper, I mean, this didn't affect me. I mean, I had to get up for my watches, you see, sort of 4 hours on... originally 4 hours on, 8 hours off. But then in your 8 hours off, you have to do your training, cleaning stations, laundry, take your turn in the mess, serving the meals, that sort of thing, and washing up, scrubbing the mess deck, that sort of thing. So, I mean, you never got the complete 8 hours off. Later on the ship, I specialised in direction finding.
I'll come back to that. So, I mean, so tell us about the mess, the cleaning the mess. I mean, how much time did you spend on that?
Oh, quite a bit, because you had to, all the lockers were highly polished. The fronts had to be polished. Everybody was responsible for polishing his own locker. But when you were duty in cleaning the mess, I mean, you had to scrub the tables and scrub the benches alongside and scrub the deck, that sort of thing. Empty the gash. I don't remember any security on entering the gash over the side in those days at that stage, although it became important at different operations where you couldn't empty it over the side because obviously you both could pick up information from it. But I don't recall there being any restrictions and being in the middle of the Atlantic.
And so you've got your cleaning duties. We've talked about the watch system more. And so that would be just your day on and off like that. Yeah. What about the food? What kind of food did you get and what mess system was it? You know, general mess.
General messing.
Tell me how that worked.
Well, you had two people in your mess detailed off as cooks, you know, for the week. And when it was prior to mealtime, they'd go up to the galley and come down with the trays with all the food in and the sweet and that sort of thing, and then they would serve it out on the table.
Would they prepare the food, the two?
Just go and fetch it, because general messing is done in the all cooked in the galley by chefs.
What was the food like? What tell us what sort of food you'd get in a day for breakfast, dinner, and lunch?
It was quite good. I mean, you know, sort of sausage and beans for breakfast, or. One of the great favourites in the Navy, and they always did it very well, was deviled kidneys on toast. I've never tasted deviled kidneys on toast other than you get in the Navy. I don't know what the recipe was, but my wife always mentions that from when she was in the Rent. Deviled kidneys and, you know, eggs and bacon and things like that for breakfast. Lunchtime, you had a soup and you had a main course. And I mean, there was no variety. It was take it or leave it. You know, sort of not like later on in the Navy when you had a lot of choices. On the whole, I mean, quite wholesome food and quite good.
And enough of it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And what about things like the ablutions? What were the heads and the washing and the shower? Yeah. What were they like?
Oh, they're fine. On the boys' mess deck, you had a big bathroom for showers and hand basins for washing. And also you did your dobing in it. The prize thing of any sailor was his bucket. Everybody owned a bucket and used to keep it nicely polished and used to sort of mark your initials on it because you did your dobing in that. And you could also bath yourself because in a sailor's bathroom you go in there with a towel around your waist, naked, you don't take any clothes in there. And sometimes you get water sloshing around the deck all the time, so you're paddling in it virtually. So, you know, you could use buckets to wash yourself down and then get under the shower. Sometimes the cold water showers were hot, you know, when you're in the tropics. So they always had a salt water shower, and that was nice and cold. So it's quite often if you were a bit hot, you went under the salt water shower.
And was there plenty of water, usually?
Oh, yeah. I mean, on the capital ships like that, they had their own evaporators for... evaporators, from the engineering point of view, a lot of maintenance is required because they get clogged up with salt, that sort of thing, and it is an expensive process, so they try not to, to waste water anyway.
So you had the showers, and tell me a bit more about this. How did you actually do the laundry in a bucket? Because people now, you're washing in a bucket, people now can't understand it.
Well, I mean, hard soap. You know, in those days, we didn't have Persil's and Daz and all that sort of thing. It's hard soap, and you use your knuckles and rub it well, and you know, keep rubbing well. later on, I remember when we, depending on what port you called in and what stores you could get, I mean, it went from the ridiculous to the sublime, because I've known times when you're doing your dobing with Lux toilet soap, and you're washing your face with detergent powder, because that was all you could get. It just varied during the war. Like.
And what about drying your clothes? You know, after you've done them in the bucket, where would you put them up to dry?
We used to take them up on the forecastle, because the forecastle on the aircraft carries, you know, he's undercover, but the sides are open. And, you know, you've got the flight deck above and you've got deck below, but you've got gaps around the side. And you used to have your own little line, a cod line, which you used to take up and tie up and sort of hang. But you weren't allowed to have dobbing hanging up when you're entering harbour or leaving harbour, that sort of thing.
And what about the heads themselves? Were they just normal toilets, or were there these ones with a gully that goes sort of down on a slope?
No, normal pistol type toilets on the wall. Or the bulkhead, I should say. Been a civvy too long now. And, you know, the sit-me-downs, where, you know, the doors are about sort of 3 foot, so, you know, they're open at the top and open at the bottom.
But they weren't the ones with the channel running right down?
No.
They were probably separate ones. What about anything else about what about your hobbies? About, you know, some of the boys or sailors have hobbies. Yeah. You know, just sort of carving things or doing things.
Don't have much time for hobbies, really.
Not really.
No. I mean, you're what with one thing or another, and I intended to get promoted as quick as I could, because the system in the Navy, because in the system in the Navy in those days, the pension was based on an able seaman rate. Now, for every year you'd held a leading hands rate, you got so many pence a day extra. And then likewise for a petty officer and the chief. And I thought, well, the war's on, promotion's going to be quicker. If I can pass the exams and get there as quick as I can, which will mean I'll get a bigger pension. Which didn't work out, because before I came out of the Navy, they changed the scheme where everybody got the same, you know, all chiefs got, providing you'd held the rank for 2 years, all chiefs got the same pension, all POs got the same pension, all in there, so that went by the board.
So, anything else, any characters aboard the ship or that you particularly remember?
Oh yeah, we had, you know, because being wartime, we had, funny enough, a lot of the people that commissioned the Formidable had come out of naval detention quarters. In other words, you know, what we called skates. But I mean, in Civvy Street there wouldn't be criminals, but they'd broken laws in the Navy. That sort of thing. But the amazing thing was the honesty on board. They would nick anything off the passer, as they call it. If they could get in the passer's store and the Jack Dusty wasn't looking, they'd pinch something. But they never touched another man's gear. I can remember one occasion when there was a halfpenny on the mess table, and the duty cooks, when they, every time they scrubbed the table, they took it off, scrubbed the table, put it back. It stayed there for weeks before someone said it's mine.
And how did you get on generally with the other boys?
Oh, very good. Yeah, very good.
No problem, no bullying or anything?
No, nothing like that. You had a couple of petty officers in charge of the boys' mess deck, you know, they, you know, looked after and that sort of thing.
Did you have any particular pals amongst the boys? You know, people that you got on well with particularly?
One chappy, Mouldy, known as Mouldy Payne. That was his nickname. Mouldy Payne was a great pal of mine. But funny enough, I palled up with a more senior chap later, because, we'll come to that later, actually, but after we got bombed and, you know.
Okay. There we come. And what about the petty officers that were in charge and your instructors? Yeah. What were they like?
Very good. You know, you sort of. You had a signal officer, who you didn't see much of, because he dealt with the more senior people. Then you had a commissioned telegraphist. You know, he had the thick gold band. You know, because he had the warrant telegraphist. Then what they call a senior commissioned telegraphist. Had a chief petty officer telegraphist. Then we had four petty officer telegraphists, one in charge of each watch, because the number of leading there. One of the other things on the mess deck, which happened after I left the boys' mess deck, was the seniority. The mess tables and the mess benches run athwart ships. The senior man sat by the bulkhead, and you went down the table, and the most junior sat on the table at the centre of the ship. And at that end, you had a piece of quarter scene on the table where all the pots were on. And under the table, you used to have a line where you'd hang the cloths. And there was a gash bucket there where all the gash went in, so the junior bloke sat with all the pots, pans and the gash bucket. And it was your ambition to work your way up the table to get by the bulkhead.
Now, anything else happened? You went down into the Atlantic and you're looking for the Admiralty. Anything else happening in this time?
No, as I say, it's...
Were you sailing with other ships, I presume?
We had... When we went down to Freetown on the first journey, we had a cruiser with us, because that was the first time the chief put me on distribution and control of gunfire wave, where you're controlling gunfire by... Now, that's another thing where they were clever. I thought, I'd never done this before, and he said, get on bay so-and-so and so-and-so, tune into such a frequency, and you will do the distribution control of gunfire with...
Now, tell me about that. We're interested in that.
He handed me a little procedure book, that was all, just handed to me. Got the distribution and control of gunfire. And what it happens is that the Hawkins would be towing a target, or if not towing a target, that they do what they call a throw-off shoot. They throw off so many degrees astern or something like that. And then the Hawkins would report by various little code letters whether the shot was short, over, to the right or to the left, and which, you as the operator were reporting, and you kept doing this until you got a straddle. And this is where another thing where they sort of, the training was good. I thought I was the one responsible, but I was sitting there in the office, and there was a more senior man up with a gunnery officer with earphones on and a Morse key in case he had to interrupt listening. So, I mean, this is how they brought you on. But I thought it was all mine. A bit terrified at the time, not having done it before.
So you were basically passing down the fire instructions and
ranging back and forth. You see.
Where were you based?
I was in the main wireless office doing that. As I say, there was a remote position up on the gunnery direction platform, which this other more senior operator was there, so he knew he could cover if everything's all right, but I didn't know this.
Anything else happening? You're still a boy then?
Still a boy, yeah. And after we left Freetown, we went via Cape Town to go up into the Medcos, the Illustrious. She was a carrier before us, and she took a terrific pounding of our air attack, and we went out to relieve her. So we called in at Cape Town on the way round, because it was too dangerous to going through the Med, because the German controlled the Italian airfield, Pantelleria, North Africa, that sort of thing. Basically, the only ships they'd seen through were the mineland cruisers. They were the fastest ships in the world. They did 47 knots. So if there was anything urgent, they make a dash through.
But you were going via the Suez Canal.
We were going via the Suez. Now, in Cape Town, the thing that stuck out in my mind was the hospitality of the people. You used to come out of the dockyard, and as you walked up the road to the town, all along the side of the road was lined up cars. And the South Africans, either a chap and his wife, or a chap and his wife and some of his family, would say, do you want to come home with us? Jump in the car, take you home. They'd take you home, look after you, take you around. And I remember catching a bus going into Muizenberg, which is a little seaside resort there, and stood looking in this fruiterer's window at all this wonderful fruit, with rations at home. And Muizenberg was quite a Jewish fraternity there, this chappy came up to me and he said, don't suppose you see fruit like that in the UK, do you? So I said, no. And he so come in with me and I'll buy you some. Well, what we used to do was take one of our pillowcases and fold it up and stick it in our jumper to use as a shopping bag. And I remember he filled this pillowcase full of fruit. And all the time I was in the Navy, I still had a stain on that pillowcase from a peach that had leaked. After we left Cape Town, on the way to go through the Red Sea and the Suez, our aircraft bombed Mogadishu and Kismayo, which is an Italian Somaliland, I believe it was then known as. I remember the old...
Was that the first time you'd see them... Was that the first missions in action you'd
seen them? Yeah, really, the aircraft in action, yeah. Because I remember seeing them come back because they were sawfish. We had mainly albacores, sawfish, and formers that were the fighters. They were twin-seater fighters. And the sawfish coming back because they were all canvas and dope, you know, big holes in the wings and canvas flapping around, that sort of thing. Then we went up through, I think we called in Aden. Yes, we did. We called in at Aden because comes to my mind that I was then qualified as a DF operator, so I was doing two watches. I was doing
direction. Now, let's talk about this.
Direction finder.
You're still a boy, though.
Still a boy, yeah.
Now, tell me what the direction finder operator did.
Well,
and what training did you had?
I was trained by a leading hand who was in charge of the direction finding office. It was a soundproof office up in the island on the carrier, as they call it, next to the remote control office, which is the office that on board ship used to use for manoeuvring. Chaps on there on manoeuvring ways, because you manoeuvre ships by wireless signal. It was soundproof, big thick door, I remember, with a big hand on it. It was a very, very old-fashioned type of direction finder. It was also MF and HF.
What do you mean by that, MF?
Medium frequency and high frequency. But the high frequency I was never used because that was not accurate. And I remember I took the Formidable into Aden Harbour on using MF bearings.
Now, how did it all work? I mean, I'm not familiar with it at all.
Spread around in different parts of the area around there, Africa, that sort of thing. There were beacons sending signals. And I remember it was thick mist, and because they hadn't got the sort of surface radars like they've got, you know, today. We had airborne radars for the aircraft, but what I would do was take bearings. And when I got cross fixes, pass it to the bridge, and we went slowly into harbour using my MF bearing, and I felt quite proud of that as a youngster, sort of doing that.
And did you need much training for that, or was it pretty simple once you got the hang of it?
Oh, it's pretty simple. It was a very old-fashioned set called the LM1, if I remember rightly, the LM1. And if you saw someone taking a bearing, it was a bit like a madhouse, because when you take a bearing on an MFDF set, if the signal's too strong, you don't get a very good bit, so you've got to sort of cut down. You're using the goniometer, you know, because the aerial's fixed, but the goniometer electronically replicates that because it's got coils of wire inside. And you have to sort of get nulls, and then you have a sense aerial to get which direction, because you can get a null in both directions, say north and south. So you want to find out whether it's actually north or south. So you use your what they call the sense aerial. You switch that in, and when you're on your null, you turn to the right, and if the signal decreases, you turn to the left, it increases. That's the correct direction. Otherwise, it's the opposite direction. But this thing, being so old-fashioned, you cut down the power by opening two doors in the top. It's a massive set, and there was a little jack plug on the end of a wire, and there was your amplifier valves there, and you used to go bum, 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 like this, very quickly, because you had to take these bearings, what they call snap bearings sometimes, you had to take them very quickly.
And this was the LM1 direction finder.
The LM1 direction finder, yeah. Later on in the Navy, we had a much better one called the FM12, that's an MF.
But not on the Formidable.
Not when I was on there, no, it might have come on the latest. And also, later on in the war, they had what they call the FH4, which was an HF direction finder, which had great success against the U-boats because that was very accurate. I believe it was designed by a Pole, but I'm not sure.
So were you not doing the other your other wireless tasks?
Oh, yes. Four watches in the main office on the main communications side. Mind you, basically a strict WT silencing force, so you're basically receiving all the time, all coded and ciphered messages coming from the main broadcast.
So you were doing that, and you were doing shifts on the LM1.
On the DF1, yeah.
Which did you prefer?
Oh, both of them. I like both of them.
So it wasn't, you know.
Yeah. I mean, in the quiet periods, I mean, when I was on my own, say in the middle watch of the night, I used to practice all sorts of things. I used to turn the light off to see if I could operate everything in the dark. So I used to sort of imagine in my mind if we'd been attacked and the power had gone this and that and they still wanted burn. Another time, when we was in the tropics, I mean, quite often what you did in the wireless office, you took your sandals and your socks off and you had a wet bit of rag, you know, like a flannel on the floor, and you put your feet on that to keep them cool. Like, see. So sometimes I used to sit there and I used to take bearings with my feet. Just to amuse myself in the middle of the night while I was doing it, sort of, because you pick up different stations. So, you know, it was, and thinking that, you know, all these things would come in handy in an emergency.
And so what's the next thing?
We passed up through the Red Sea, stopping at Port Sudan, I think, is it? Halfway up the Red Sea, Port Sudan. The RAF had a big base there. We'd been Saudi Arabia. And I know they challenged us to a water polo match because swimming was my game. Because we were been on the ship for months, I mean, you know, the RAF ashore were nice and fit. And I had to be lifted out of the water. I mean, God knows what the older men were like, but I mean, I was a young boy and quite fit compared with them. And I was so whacked at the end of it, I had to be virtually lifted out of the water. And we lost.
Where did you play it? I mean,
they had a swimming pool in Port Sudan there. Yeah. Then the other interesting thing, when we, obviously the Germans knew that, you know, from their own intelligence, either knew or surmised that we would be, someone was coming through to relieve the illustrious, and they had a report that there could have been magnetic mines dropped in the Bittern Lakes. And that's the fastest I've ever gone through the Suez Canal. I don't think it, because there is a speed restriction on the Suez Canal. I don't know what, only a few knots. And what we did, for the first part, we lowered a sea boat with seamen in, and they went ahead of the ship zigzagging up the canal. Little did they know that was so they get blown up and not the ship. And then they got taken back aboard, and before we got to the Bittern Lakes, the Formidable got full speed up and she absolutely charged through there, and you could see the wash going up the banks and the sand coming down in the canal. And as soon as we hit the Bittern Lakes, everything electrical was switched off on the ship and we just glided through. And then we entered the canal the other end, finally coming out, and we were based on Alexandria then with the Eastern Med Fleet.